Hello listeners, welcome to the Afriwetu podcast, where we look to celebrate African history, people and culture by telling our story. As always, our hope is that it fills you with enough curiosity to go and do your own deeper research. Karibuni to any new listeners to the Afriwetu world. We invite you to check out previous Afriwetu episodes, which can be found on this podcast platform. Thank you so much for tuning in today. We are headed to West Africa for part two of the Ouagadou Empire. A shout out to my West Africans out there. Afriwetu is back on your borders. Before we begin, please remember to visit us on our socials. Our handle is at Afriwetu, where we shall be posting interesting facts, stories, updates, and if you please, any links for further study for you lovely people. But for today, I just want you to sit back and enjoy the journey. We are back to this massive empire, but before we go any further, yep, you know the drill. Pull out those maps and let's head across to the west to locate this wonder. So, looking at the continent, go west to the far side and there you will spot the Sahel. If you look at where Senegal and Isaber River's headwaters meet, that region where the modern nations of Mauritania, Mali, Guinea, and Senegal meet, that is where we shall be spending time today. Basically, that is where the Ouagadou Empire was located, sandwiched as it was between the desert and the rainforests of the region. Now, for those who haven't had a chance to listen to part one yet, don't worry, I will give you just a very brief look just to get you into the zone, and then we shall continue. So, in part one, we looked into the dope origin story of this empire. The Soninke version is what we focused on, starting with Dinge Cisse and from whom the royal Cisse dynasty came. And then we met his sons, where we saw the deception of the younger brother, Diabe, taking as he did the blessings of kinship that were due to his older brother, Kine. There was a giant python who demanded, virgin sacrifices in exchange for protection and wealth for the empire. From there, we went to consider the archaeology surrounding the empire. And together with the study of anthropology, we were able to link the Soninke story of Diabe, Dinge, and Kine. We met the people, and this also nicely led us to the final section, which was a city living in the empire, a glimpse into what it must have physically looked like. It was at this point that I realized that we needed to do something different with this empire, and I did say there was a surprise in this episode. It will be at the very end, so yes, stay tuned to the end. Yes, I know it is gimmicky, I'm sorry. Right, so now that we're all together and all caught up, as we heard in part one, there's a great deal of value placed on Arab writings around this empire's workings and even more interesting interpretations of the same. For the Arab writers, it is totally understandable their skew on the empire, considering its importance to the Muslim world, because once in that area, Islam had become very widespread in the region. The beauty here at Afriwetu is that we're all about just scratching a little bit under the surface. So let's just do that and see the other side of the coin from a more Black African perspective, i.e. just going back to the roots. And let's start with religion. So we met Bida, the great seven-headed python. And the Soninke's people's religion was based on this mythical tale, practicing an animist religion across the social strata. One of the main rituals around Bida was the annual virgin sacrifice. The sacrifice was to ensure the continued prosperity of the kingdom, and we shall come back to it in a bit. But back to the more mundane and a teaching moment, the animist religions, for those who may not know, is a form of religion that sees everything as having a soul and each one is connected to the spirit world, not just humans. So more common examples include Hinduism, Buddhism, and Shinto. In this empire, within the royal family and the nobles' homes, one would find numerous shrines which would hold personal objects that were viewed as sacred. So for rulers, the worship of Buddha was a key element. And to show their bond and allegiance to them, upon their ascension to the throne, each ruler had to make a visit to the sacred grove and pay homage. Gather round, friends. I hear you are new to our homelands, and your guide tells me that you are interested in understanding our traditional rites and rituals. So let me share them with you. Sit, be comfortable. Somebody, get them some soup. Is this how we treat our guests? Warm soup appears from seemingly nowhere as we settle in. Okay. So you have already heard about our great python protector, Buddha, he who lives in the most sacred grove right near the royal enclosure. There is actually more than one sacred grove, but Buddha's is the one where every new ruler has to go and pay homage on ascension to the throne. And at their end, they are returned back and buried in these sacred groves. It is also the one where every year the most beautiful virgin is sacrificed. A very high honor for the family, not so much fun for the young woman, but we must all play our part. It is at this time that we equally thank Buddha for a good harvest, great trade and wealth, and the prosperity in our lands. It is he who provides the rainfall that we need for our harvest. And when the rain falls, after that we find the gold that we use for trade, and that these foreigners seem to love so much. They really like these shiny things. We value salt more, but I digress. But Buddha is not our only deity. We have many other spirits that we call on for our protection. Our royals lead the way, having as they do quite a number of objects from masks to statuettes which represent these deities. We have the skilled who made these from all the materials you can find in our lands, wood, terracotta, and other materials. But the most talented are our blacksmiths, who use their magical skills and work with fire to forge objects of wonder out of this thing you call iron. These blacksmiths hold a very special place as our priests. They live in those houses you saw near the palace. It is they who keep the secrets of the spirits and the special rituals. Only if you are initiated into a recognized society can you learn of them. The priests go into the sacred groves to commune with the spirits deep in the forests around us and to make sure, please make sure you don't enter. But there are also guards that surround it. However, there are some people who have refused to follow our rules. Be very careful, because if you join them and even accidentally enter these groves, those who have made that mistake have never been heard or seen from again. The sacred groves are also used as punishment for crimes. Knowing that they cannot escape the spirits, criminals are sent in one sentence, and there the deities will deal with them accordingly. Many have tried to come and show us their new religions, but our rulers and nobles have resisted. Those who have joined those foreign religions, we know they're going to do it for the sake of business. Sure, this love of money will kill us. But we welcome foreigners, and some are even in our royal courts as advisors to our rulers, the Ghana. They have actually set up their own town, set aside specially for them and their places of worship. They pray to a deity called Allah. But this is not our story. Ah, look, I see they're getting ready for a festival. Can you see them carrying those masks and statuettes, which represent the different deities? Some are malignant, some are benevolent. The world is made up of good and evil, and so are the spirits. So let's go. We commune, give some ritual offerings, mostly foodstuffs, and then we celebrate these festivals according to their sacred objects. In fact, as they're about to start, let's go and watch before you leave. Eh? After the festival, we find ourselves back in the present. Before we leave this section, let's touch on this foreign religion they spoke of. Obviously, it was Islam. Now, naturally, because of a lot of the writings related to this empire were from the Muslim Arabs, there is a great deal of emphasis on the place of Islam, which is spreading across the Sahara from the 7th and 8th centuries. This was seen to be a byproduct of the Muslim merchants who came through as traders. Many hypothesize that the people of Ouagadou, as good business practice, converted to Islam for the sake of trade, which is not very far-fetched. It is also at the same time period from around the 11th century that we see the formation of the Muslim towns that was set aside specially for the traders and also hosted the emperor's advisors, scholars, clerics, and jurists. In all this, as we know, the people, the rulers, and the royal family and the courts kept to their own traditions, not converting until much later, close to the 12th century. And speaking of traditions, just wanted to say, now that you're all here, the skill with which the people created the religious objects that were directly reflective of their religion are today seen as fine works of art and have great monetary value, which unfortunately at the time of this recording was still being held in museums in Europe and the US. Indeed, one cannot deny that they are magnificent and to be admired, but these masks and statues were not made for casual or academic display. Their value is cultural, imbued as they are, or with the skilled person's reverence for their rituals and what these objects represented. So let's hope that their descendants get them back, right? As the rightful keepers of their history. Yeah? Anyway, leaving that there for a second as it sinks in, let's walk over to see the governance of this empire. So the empire was led by the Ghana, one of the titles to mean the ruler. The term Ghana means warrior king in the Mande language. Other terms included the Magan, which is claimed to be the origin of the word Ghana, and another was Tunka, which is the ruler's class or clan. He was an absolute monarch and held a sacred kingship. He was the final say when it came to all things governance and religion as the most supreme in both, receiving both tribute and sacrifice. He ruled from the royal courts in the capital city of the day. Remember, in part one, we did see that this site could change, and Kumbi was just one of the cities in the course of the empire's existence. The empire ran a feudal system of governance, with individual tributary kings being left to continue their rule mostly uninterrupted, and they also provided a source of wealth through their tribute. The ruler, although absolute, did still surround himself with a council of advisors, and they were pulled not just from the Soninke, his priests and the nobility, but also from the Nubis, the Muslims who came in as travelers and traders. By all accounts, the Ghana was accommodating of new ideas and information, as well as those from different cultures. When it came to religion, which we looked at earlier, there were very clear guidelines in the animist religion of the Soninke, but this did not preclude inviting and allowing the new religions from being represented in his courts and in key positions. In fact, it was well known that from the 12th century, when Islam really started to take more of a hold, one could find Muslim officials in the treasury, leveraging on their skills as traders in dealing with the various merchants who came through the empire. They were also very present in diplomatic service, possibly, I would assume, for the same reason. The empire used a system of taxes for both imported and exported goods, with heavy taxes placed on gold, one of its key exports. The Ghana and the royal family held a firm grip on the gold trade. This commodity contributed greatly to their own personal wealth. It was said that they would keep gold nuggets and the people gold dust. In regards to the legal system, crime was dealt with severely. What constituted an act of crime included murder, theft, adultery, and other petty crimes. How one's guilt was determined was typical of that period in time, what we know as trial by ordeal. So, one example I read was that the accused would be forced to drink a bitter brew, and their guilt or innocence was pegged on if they either vomited or ingested it. I know, right? The punishment for these crimes ranged and depended on the severity of the crime. So adultery, huge crime, was punishable by being flayed, i.e. whipped. A thief could be sold into slavery, and even the death sentence could apply. Such was the seriousness of crime taken in the civilization. For this to be effective, it meant that the Ghanas at the head of all, together with their council, had to lead by example. As we are here, let us have a closer look at these rulers in a little bit more detail before we close out this episode. I can hear all of you gasping. Okay, I know you're all wondering, it's part two and we're not ending with the demise. I will explain after this, I promise. But before we do so, I think we should take one last trip of the day. And just like that, we find ourselves transported back to about 1068 and back with our Guimel outside the royal palace grounds. There's a lot of drumming and a procession of men on horseback streaming into the compound. I see you have come back to visit. You're just in time. The ruler and his top military chiefs have just finished their daily rounds of the city. Today was a long one, so many had grievances to report to them. These drums you hear are announcing their return. We're a bit perplexed, and she can tell. Oh, you don't have the system where you come from? Such shame. Okay, so here our rulers ride into the city and everyone has access and can petition them directly to solve an injustice done to them. The Ghana and his commanders then listen and then look to solve that issue. Okay, we understand. She then leads us through the walled area into the royal enclosure. It is filled with domed buildings. Ahead of us is one very large one, and she tells us that this is the Ghana's residence. It is incredibly green, with lots of trees close by, and she tells us that this is a sacred grove that only the ruler and his priest can access. It is where Bida resided. In addition, she tells us that these sacred groves were where the tombs of previous rulers are housed. We pass at the buildings that look like they also house royalty, and we find out that these belong to the wives of the ruler, where they live with their children, and a full household of staff to cater to their needs. Our Gwel points to the smaller houses where the royal staff live, the servants, the guards, the chiefs, and the chefs, and so on. We continue onwards, and the sound of drums becomes louder and louder. Surrounding us, we are in time to see the last of the army commander's guards. The drums get to a crescendo and then boom, 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 at a nod. Silence. our guide leads us to a seating space in the royal court. We see a pavilion with some serious-looking pedigree dogs standing guard, wearing gold and silver collars with bells on them, alert to all movements. As we settle, we find that we are none other than Tunkamanin's court. Like, this is a proper celebrity Ghana. She tells us that his has been the most lavish court of the empire to date, and truly, it's a sight to behold. Let's start with the clothes, shall we? The splendor of the fabric and the colors worn by the Ghana and his courtiers. Tunkamanin has on his head an intricately designed turban-like cotton cap woven with gold, obviously. Coming down to his upper body, we see a collar, bracelets, necklaces of gold and silver sitting on his torso. He's surrounded by very well-dressed nobles and courtiers, clean-shaven men and women with shaved heads. In this mix with ministers, princes, and such like, who, depending on their rank and means, ranged from wearing gilded headdresses, outfits made from the finest silks, brocades that are bejeweled with precious stones, like the real ones, right? Not your costume jewelry or cubic zirconium. Our girl interrupts our awe to tell us that today, Tunkamanin is listening to the petitions of his subjects in the pavilion. His pages stand around him, hair plated with gold, holding their gold-decorated shields and swords, in front of the horses, which are also covered in gold-embroidered cloth. Like, there's just gold everywhere. She points out the duba, the drum that summons petitioners. We see one man approaching the throne. He gets on his knees, his head is sprinkled with gold dust, as is a custom when meeting Ghana, and he begins his ask. We shall stay on for a bit to experience this court, and of course there's a banquet later, hosted by the governor, who is seated near Tunkamanin, and he's known to throw it down. So that was fun. Now back to present day, the morning after. What we do know is that the Soninke, like other Mande-speaking people, are patrilineal and succession was through the male lineage. Although some do argue that this was not always the case and that there was sometimes preference for the maternal line from the ruler to his sister's son. The case of Tunkamanin was just such a situation, in that he ascended into the throne following his maternal uncle, Ghana Basi. Basi had come to power when he was much older, at the age of 85. He was an older and somewhat less active ruler. He's actually said to have been blinded at some point, but this was a secret within the courts and kept from his subjects. They were able to keep this secret because his ministers would stick close by, and then they would either whisper or use verbal cues to help cover this particular infirmity. Basi, it was said to have actually been one of the most accommodating of rulers, especially when it came to his court and the inclusion of non-Soninke, who made up a significant number as ministers and interpreters in the court. On his death, Tunkamanin took over, and we can assume that Basi's funeral and burial rites followed the more standard pattern, which was that he would have been buried in the sacred grove, which we saw within the royal enclosure. He would have had one large dome constructed from wood, built over where he was going to be laid as his final resting place. The body would have been dressed in fine robes, placed on carpets and cushions. Weapons and ornaments and his utensils that he would have used to eat and drink and foodstuffs would have been placed next to him, as would have his personal servants. Once all is done, everything would be covered, layer upon layer of mats and soil and garments buried underneath, including his servants. And on that last note, now seems like a good place to end. So let's look at what else was happening in the world before we bring it home. Cool? So, in the 5th century, in North Acropolis, Tikal, Guatemala, is built. In the mid-6th century, the cave temple of the Shiva at Elephants Caves, Maharashtra, India, is built. These elephant caves are a collection of cave temples predominantly dedicated to the Hindu god Shiva and have been designated a UNESCO World Heritage Site. The spread of Islam and the Muslim conquest began with the unification of Arabia by Muhammad starting in 622. And in fact, 622 is year one of the Islamic calendar, during which the Hiraj occurs. Muhammad and his followers emigrate from Mecca to Medina. In 545, the Nubian kingdom of Nubatia converts to Christianity. And in 578, the world's oldest ongoing company to date, the Kongo Gumi, is founded in Osaka, Japan. Look it up. As we bring it home, my people, this empire had a lot going on. So guess what? You may have noticed that we did not end with a demise, as is the normal pattern. And this is because, as an Afriwetu first, there will be a part 3. Don't worry, I wasn't going to leave you hanging. And with very good reason, you will see when this trilogy is over. Our ancestors blew me away. And see, I have even changed the Afriwetu pattern to accommodate them. Guys, always listen to your elders is our culture, because they are wiser than us. But back to this episode and some final thoughts. I was just dazzled by the richness of culture, the wonder of the royal courts, the love of their own customs, and it is so very easy to see why this empire was admired and has been the subject of many studies and curiosity over the ages, right? And then a really cool fact I wanted to end this show with was the part about the drums. So we heard how the army commanders were preceded and announced by drums, right? Well, did you know it is said centuries later, another great empire, the Songhai, yes, we covered it in season 2, episodes 14 and 15 in Afriwetu, but the Songhai Empire, during the rule of the Asikia dynasty, they adopted this very same tradition for their high commanders, who were then called the drum lords. And on that, as we beat the last drums before we close, thank you so much for listening. And we'll see you in part 3 of this empire. And until then, may you find the riches and the wisdom of rulers and empires. Until next time, Mubarikiwe.